Welcome back, and we're going to now talk about multiple myeloma. We have Regina Flores from the Florida Cancer Specialist in Orlando. Welcome, Regina. And Dr. Natalie Callender from the University of Wisconsin-Carbone Cancer Center. And Dr. Tom Martin from the UCSF Helen Diller Comprehensive Cancer Center in San Francisco. So we're going to start out talking about current and emerging approaches to myeloma, and then we're going to dive into CAR T, bispecifics, and antibody drug conjugates. So much to talk about there. But before we get started with Natalie's presentation, why don't we start out with a case from Regina? I always love cases that start out 93-year-old. So let's hear about this 93-year-old.
So in our quest for immortality, I decided to present a 93-year-old gentleman who came in for anemia and back pain. He has a long-standing history of diabetes, which is well controlled. He has had CKD stage 3. He came in with his son. Since he's 93, they're very protective of him. He still walks around on his own, no cane. But he's very sharp still. So my question is, what would you do with this 93-year-old? Would you treat him with a quad? Now that we have data with quad, it looks like all comers are now treated with quads, whether you're transplant eligible or not. Maybe you answer that first, and then I will follow up with a series of questions.
So Natalie, before you answer, just kind of curious about his thought, your take on him in terms of what he wanted and how concerned he was about, and his son, about toxicity, Regina.
So basically, this guy said, I will trust whatever you tell me. He was not really concerned. He wanted treatment. They have longevity in their family, living to late 90s. So he said, I'll trust you.
So Natalie, they say age is just a number, but you still have the statistics
I think that there's some important things about this case. And number one is he's symptomatic from his myeloma. So this isn't just lab findings that you're worried about. But we actually have some guidance for this age group. I think the best trial out there is an IFM trial that looked at elderly patients, median age 80. I mean, how many trials can you say do that? And what they did was remove steroids, which can really be difficult for older patients. And somebody with diabetes and CKD, I think that would be problematic. So they used daratumumab and lenalidomide with dose reductions for CKD built into that, and showed very good overall response rates and tolerability. So that would be probably what I would do. And a quad, yes, we're doing a lot more quads, but in this particular situation, I wouldn't do that.
So Tom, any thoughts? I know we have, I mentioned yesterday, Eric Ruppart and some of his colleagues from Reading, Pennsylvania, coming down here. So great to have people come up from different parts of the country that came here today to join us. And Eric, a number of times he's presented cases to us, Tom, and brings up the issue of corticosteroids in general, and particularly in older patients. Again, curious about this case, but also curious about your approach to steroid use in older people.
Yeah, so I think a big part about treatment for these patients, number one, is what Natalie said in terms of dose adjustments based on other comorbidities, especially the renal insufficiency and the dose reduction of lenalidomide. But you also have to think about the cognitive effects of these drugs. So the one that has the most cognitive change is dexamethasone. So in patients certainly that are over age 70, I never use more than 20 milligrams of dex. And I based on the IFM study, have already done limited dex, meaning especially if it's with daratumumab, we're really doing it as prophylaxis so they don't have, quote unquote, an allergic reaction. And usually at the end of cycle 2, I take them completely off dex. So it's dex for the first maybe 6 to 8 doses of daratumumab, and then they're completely off dex. The lenalidomide can also cause some cognitive change, so just be cautious about that.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this case up, because to me, when I think about older people in oncology, I think about myeloma, because you all really, I think, have been dealing with this. You have very elderly and all, really have gotten into it over the years, so it's really been a great help, not just in myeloma, but in general, in terms of older people. Okay, Natalie, let's take a look at some data.
Okay, well, I have a little bit of a potpourri for everybody today. And I want to talk about, up first, what made the biggest splash at ASH this year, no disclosures. and that's the Aquila trial. So many of you may know that the treatment of smoldering myeloma has been quite controversial. And even though we have two phase three studies that have been done with lenalidomide, adopting treatment of high-risk smoldering myeloma really hasn't caught fire. And maybe both of those trials were done with lenalidomide. There's been some concern about this. But I think, you know, there really is time to have a discussion about opening this up. So Aquila was a phase three trial of close to 400 patients who were deemed high-risk smoldering myeloma by virtue of having 10% plasma cells, which is part of the definition, but having one of those features listed. So monoclonal protein above 3 grams, an IgA monoclonal protein, free light chain ratio above 8, more than 50%, less than 60% plasma cells in a bone marrow, or a free light chain ratio above 8. Very, very simple design here. Either you had 3 years of single-agent daratumumab or observation, and the primary endpoint here was progression-free survival as defined by IMWG SlimCrab. So what the results showed here, this is the demographics. This is a relatively younger group of smoldering patients. The average age usually diagnosis is around 70. These people were in their early 60s. And as you can see in the lower right, by 20-20 criteria that many of you may be familiar with for smoldering, most of these patients are not high risk. But suffice it to say, what really got a lot of attention is this. At the 60-month follow-up point, the PFS for the DARA group hasn't been reached, and then in the active monitoring, it's 41%. And one of the things that was also notable was if you look when both groups progressed, there were many more people in the observation arm that progressed symptomatically. So they had CRAB, the relatively equal numbers of people with biochemical progression. Now, most groups look like they benefited, but once again, most of these smoldering studies show that it's really the high-risk people who benefit the most. This study had very few non-white participants, so that was a little bit hard to read out. But I think what got everybody's attention the most was this, the survival benefit. So still pretty close, 93 versus 87% at that five-year follow-up, but it was statistically significant. One criticism that's come out is that the people in the observation arm, only a handful of them got anti-CD38 therapy as part of their relapse or their initial treatment, so whether that makes a difference or not. But the expectation here is that daratumumab is going to receive an approval for smoldering myeloma probably later this year. And then moving on, I just want to mention, if you're interested in treating your high-risk smoldering myeloma patients, we do have a study going on in ECOG where we're really culling out the true high-risk patients. And we don't think observation is appropriate anymore for this group, using Dara-Len-Dex for about 2 years or Len-Dex. And so that study's out there on CTSU if you'd like to participate.
Before you go on, just to pick up on that, just kind of curious, Tom, what your thoughts are about applying the Aquila data to your practice.
So I think we have two camps, maybe three camps in myeloma. Camps that say high-risk smoldering myeloma, yes, I'm going to treat it based on the phase three data that's available. A camp that we throw our hands up, I don't know what to do. And another camp that says, no, we're going to wait and watch over time. And the big problem I see with the smoldering myeloma data that all these phase three trials included low, intermediate, and high-risk patients. It wasn't just high-risk patients. That is a problem. And when you think about smoldering myeloma, there's probably three groups of patients in that, even in the high-risk smoldering myeloma patients. There's those that have myeloma, there's those that have smoldering myeloma, and those that have MGUS. We just don't have the tools to tease out which group is the patient in. So that's why a lot of us, including me, I tend to follow them. I want to see the movie rather than the picture.
So also, Natalie, just to get back to Regina's case, if instead of this 93-year-old, it was another one, a lot of comorbidities, or maybe a patient or family who didn't want aggressive treatment, how would you think it through? Would you ever consider Dara alone?
I would, and I actually have treated patients with that. That is a pretty well-tolerated regimen. We know from in the relapse setting, the response rate's pretty low. It's only about a third. But you would expect perhaps in a newly diagnosed patient that they would tolerate that. And again, there's no renal adjustment you have to make. You can use it on dialysis for that matter. So that would be a reasonable strategy. And again, like Tom said, try to limit steroids, you know, or no steroids.
All right, Perseus.
Okay, so I think most people have heard of Perseus. If you did not believe quadruplet therapy with a transplant is the way to go, I think this study, which built on what was seen in the Griffin trial, is very convincing. So Dara VRD versus VRD, and then Dara in the maintenance. Dara gets to stop at 2 years if you're MRD negative. Probably a lot of you have seen this. This is really the best progression-free survival that's ever been seen at the four-year mark of 84%. And the other big news was that two-thirds of the patients assigned to the Dara maintenance were able to stop that, which is really beneficial. And the update here, very high response rates if we're looking at CR, but the update this year was this. So they were seeing improvement with MRD continuing over time. And so that by the three-year mark, 75% of those who got the quad are now MRD negative. And one of the very interesting things is when this study has been modeled now, the predicted median PFS in the quad is 15 years or more. I mean, that is tremendous. And so it's going to be very hard to beat that. And personally, I think there is very much here a role for transplant. I think this is part of the package. But we did this year have, for the non-transplant or non-transplant eligible group, basically the Perseus without a transplant, if you will. So in this case, the anti-CD38 is isatuximab with VRD or VRD, and then the maintenance, again, respects the anti-CD38, isatuximab's continued. This is relatively intensive treatment because the bortezomib is twice weekly through the initial treatment, but they had very good PFS data that they presented. Excellent. This is matches old transplant studies at 63.2% at that five-year mark versus 40%, and of course, better MRD negativity rates. So this is a very viable. It is basically capped at people 80, so not for your 93-year-old. And then I think there is also a lot of interest in this trial called the BENEFIT trial. And this design was basically trying to test the proposition, do you need bortezomib or not? And so they used a Maya-like backbone, in this case, isatuximab Lendex, and then added in weekly bortezomib for a time-limited period, about a year and a half, and then continued in both groups, isa and our maintenance. And what they found, this was powered for MRD, is that you have essentially a doubling of MRD benefit if you added in bortezomib for that 18-month period. Now, we did not see any difference here in PFS, but that's expected now with these combinations working so well. At 2 years, you wouldn't expect to see anything, but clearly the MRD and the overall response rate is showing a benefit. So then we want to talk about Cepheus, which is another non-transplant. In this case, a bunch of these patients are transplant deferred, not transplant ineligible. This is kind of a riff on the old SWOG VRD versus RD trial. So this adds in daratumumab and bortezomib with the quadruplet here for an 8-cycle induction and then moves to dara-RD maintenance. There again, their PFS was attainment of CR with MRD negativity, and an inclusion of this quadruplet in this group about doubles that with an expected improvement in the long run on overall survival. Now, one question that comes up here is we're seeing a lot of anti-CD38 in maintenance. Do you really need it or not? This is some data that was updated this year from this old trial, Cassiopeia, where patients received bortezomib, but thalidomide and dexamethasone and a transplant. They could either have daratumumab in induction, but there was a second randomization to daratumumab as part of maintenance or observation. There had been a lot of spin that daratumumab, if you got it at one, either the back end or the front end, was fine, but there was some updated data from Philippe Moreau showing that the best outcomes were those who got daratumumab both part of induction and in maintenance, and probably really sort of confirming use of daratumumab in maintenance is really important here. There also was the ARIGA trial that was presented at the IMS meeting in Brazil. This is a maintenance trial, and this is specifically for people, very narrow criteria, not CD38 exposed during induction, had to have at least a VGPR and be MRD positive at 10^-5, and they were randomized for essentially 3 years of either daratumumab and lenalidomide or lenalidomide alone. The endpoint, again, is MRD negativity here, and really outstanding results. If you believe MRD negativity will translate to PFS and survival, which most people do at this point, and sort of any way you slice it, you had almost a tripling of MRD negativity by the inclusion of daratumumab here in maintenance. Now, you know, just a couple of caveats here. This is, again, showing what other people have said. Being MRD negative is good no matter how you get there. I think we would all agree that. There was a little bit of extra toxicity from the daratumumab in terms of upper respiratory tract infections, and there is hypogammaglobulinemia. But I guess this is, in my opinion, another reason to strongly consider the use of an anti-CD38 in maintenance, although we still don't know about that front and back piece exactly. And then, of course, I just want to remind people the DRAMATIC trial just completed accrual in January. This is a 1,400-patient study, which hopefully will answer, do you need DARA up front and behind? The randomization here is after you complete transplant with any response, you are randomized to either Len-DARA for 2 years or Len alone. And then at 2 years, you have a determination of MRD negativity at 10 to the minus 6. If you're negative, you can actually be randomized to stop or continue. Now, for better or worse, this study is powered for overall survival, so it may be many, many, many years. There is some concern about whether we can redo a endpoint and use MRD negativity. So I just want to mention some updates that came out on IKEMA, Dr. Martin's work here. If you have not used isatuximab, carfilzomib, dex, I highly recommend this. Look at that PFS, that it is approaching really a CAR T. You know, and these are people with 1 to 3 lines of therapy. There was a subgroup analysis done looking at patients who had 1 Q amp or gain. There's been a signal that maybe isatuximab works well in those patients, and this basically confirms it. There was an update also in Icaria, which is isatuximab pom-dex, showing great overall survival advantage for incorporation of isatuximab and no impact on later lines of therapy, which is important. And then we had a press release in January talking about what's called the OBDS, or on-body delivery system. This is a device you can tape on here to administer isatuximab. The anticipation, since this trial met its endpoint, it looks like, presumably it will all pan out, but we think that this may be approved this year. And so I think we'll be seeing more isatuximab use here in the U.S.
So before you go on, mm-hmm. just to pick up on that, I'm curious about this device, mm-hmm. you know, that uses a sub-Q. Tom, have you actually had patients get it? What happens? How does it compare to getting sub-Q DARA? And do you expect, I'm assuming at this point you favor DARA just because of the sub-Q. I mean, most people do. Where do you see that heading?
Yeah, that's very interesting. So obviously we all use daratumumab because it is so easy to give by subcutaneous injection. We have not used this on-body device at UCSF, but you know, I've been involved in people that have used it. And in fact, you put the device on the body, you actually hit the button, and the button will administer the dose over the next 10 to 20 minutes. So the nurse can hit the button and go do other things, rather than with daratumumab, you have to give it 3 to 5 minutes slow, you know, subcutaneous injection. So it might actually end up being the most convenient way to give a CD38. We'll see.
Self-administration, do you see?
Good question. I think it'll depend on insurers and whether they're going to pay for it if patients take these things at home and put them on once a week.
So as always the case, Natalie, doesn't take too long to have people start asking about MRD in clinical practice. Several questions about that, including from Hassan, mm-hmm. Using the maintenance setting to determine mm-hmm. whether to use R alone or RD. Any thoughts in general about MRD in the community?
Right. I think, we've had this discussion many, many times about the use of MRD outside of a trial. And I think there's still some caveats to consider. All MRD is not the same. There's MRD by flow. There's MRD by next generation sequencing. There is some concern about quality of the specimen. And then, of course, the timing of when you do it. In transplant, it's a little bit easier because we'll say, okay, we're going to do it before transplant and then day 100 and maybe at 1 year. And there are people who are starting to de-escalate, particularly in standard or low-risk myeloma. I think with our group here in myeloma, I think we all say high-risk individuals, we're not going to stop if they're MRD negative with their maintenance treatments.
So I'm going to give Regina a chance to bring up a few questions. But first, coming back to you, Tom, sort of the age-old question, which I still am asking after seeing the determination trial, which is your thoughts about transplant nowadays as opposed to delayed transplant, and do you counsel patients differently if they're African-American?
Very good question. So in terms of delayed transplant, we in the U.S. have not been good at doing delayed transplants. So I really, the timing to do it is in the first year of diagnosis. Based on the data that Natalie showed you, the Perseus data with the projected PFS of almost 200 months, so a long time, over 15 years, versus in the transplant ineligible without a transplant, more like 90 to 100 months. So even though these are not, you know, randomized trials, I do think transplant still deepens your response and gives you a much more durable remission duration. So I still am a believer in transplant, especially if they have any high-risk cytogenetic abnormalities.
African-Americans?
Yeah, so African-Americans. So the determination trial, there wasn't really a big advantage for transplant. And I think that's still, that's we have one trial that we've seen it. I think we really need to actually enroll more Black African-American patients on clinical trials so we really can tease out the answer to this question. I don't think we really know the answer.
Yeah, it's interesting. I asked Paul Richardson. They somehow got 19% of their patients African-American. I said, how did you do it? And he said, we got African-American oncologists to champion the trial. I was just flashing on 15-year DFS. That's 2040. Yes. Can you imagine how you're going to be treating relapse in 2040?
Right.
And I love it when I see these myeloma cases that go from trial to trial to trial, and you know they keep doing better. Regina, any questions you want to throw in there?
So, you know, if you have these patients that you treat with a quad up front, then you knock out all four drugs, you know, groups. So what would be your sequence? Let's say you have a patient who had quad. Would it be selinexor? Would it be, you know, KPD? If it's a 93-year-old, will it be PD, you know?
Belantamab?
And then be CAR-T. That's the other one.
I personally think that there has been lots of utility seen with belantamab. We're very much hoping it comes back. It is a very easy to use drug in older individuals. At least that's been my experience, particularly when you can do very attenuated dosing, maybe every 3 months or so. So I do want to make the point, there's a big difference between people who are Dara-Len refractory and Dara-Len exposed. And so I think that, you know, if you had that combination of somebody who's, maybe they're having some sort of elaborate quad maintenance, that's probably the patient that we're going to push towards the cellular therapy that we're going to hear about, probably in second line.
All right, selinexor. Yeah. We were talking with the GYN people yesterday about selinexor.
And the myelofibrosis people.
Myelofibrosis. GYN people say, oh, no problem, give them selinexor. But I said, well, let's ask the myeloma people.
So selinexor, you know, there have been some issues, but it continues to be of interest for us because there is this suggestion that maybe it's going to improve T-cell fitness, which might be a nice bridging therapy before some sort of T-cell redirecting treatment. So the Boston trial, again, was a comparison between weekly bortezomib, selinexor, and dexamethasone, or twice weekly bortezomib and dexamethasone, that showed an advantage in terms of PFS. But I think what there was some concern because there was increased hematologic toxicity in those receiving selinexor. Clearly less peripheral neuropathy, which was great. But one of the sub-analyses that came out recently was this. So if for whatever reason your selinexor dose was reduced from 80 milligrams down to either 40 or 60, you actually did so much better. But not just with side effects, you did better in terms of your progression-free survival, almost double the rate with that lower selinexor dose, and actually better response. You improved your response. And I think people who've used selinexor, which I've had the advantage of being involved in some of the trials, I think we really appreciate that. These are on the left there, there's carfilzomib with lower dose selinexor. On the right, lower dose selinexor with pomalidomide, showing that those lower doses really are effective and you are able to keep patients on treatment longer. So really, really a nice strategy.
Tom, any granularity you want to add to managing patients on selinexor? I'd love to talk to Joe McHale about it. He has this whole thing that he talks about. Yeah. How do you approach these patients?
Yeah, so just before, even before they get started on selinexor, they got to have at least two anti-nausea drugs that they take as prophylaxis, a third or a fourth together if they have it there. We usually have them come weekly to check their blood counts, make sure if they have thrombocytopenia or neutropenia, they get cytokine support with that. We also give them hydration in salt tablets if they have a little hyponatremia. But to Natalie's point, it really is about dosing. If they're having side effects, you dose reduce, because patients don't do well if they're off the drug, if they can't get the drug. You want them to maintain the drug, and you want them to maintain it over time, and then those patients can really be on this for quite some time. I completely agree.
So, Natalie, we've been hearing about CELMoDs for so long. Like, when are they getting here?
Well, so there was a lot of CELMoD activity at ASH this year. I think the expectation right is now that iberdomide and mezi are going to be maybe approved in 2026. At least that's the scuttlebutt I've heard. But I just picked out one abstract among many. I thought this was quite interesting because this is using mezigdomide to actually resensitize patients who are now PI, proteasome inhibitor resistant. So this was a nice study where they looked at different cohorts. One was with bortezomib, mezi and dex, and one was with carfilzomib, mezi and dex. In a very, very heavily pretreated population, outstanding response is 75%, with half of them really approaching remission, and carfilzomib doing even better. So I think we're going to see a lot of these combinations coming out. Excalibur, which is the Dara Iber dex, a study is almost accrued. I think there's just a couple of patients left. So I think we're going to be some more activity soon.
All right. So let's bring in another case. And actually, Regina, let's go to your 60-year-old Filipino man.
Okay. So this gentleman came to me about around the time of the pandemic, or just right after 2021. He came for a second opinion. He said, you know, my oncologist is sending me to hospice. He's a diabetic, he's had some neuropathy, he came in, lost a lot of weight. They gave him RVD for 3 cycles, hyaluronic acid 3 cycles. They just quit because of intolerance to therapy. He had a lot of back pain, just failure to thrive. And so I basically stepped back and said, well, you know, you've not been on treatment for 3 months. I think we should just control your pain. He was referred to me by a radiation oncologist. So I had his bone marrow repeated 3 months off therapy, and it's actually normal cellular. He had a lesion in C-spine and T-spine, got his pain under control. So after the bone marrow was done, I sent him back to the transplanter because a few months back, transplanter said, I can't transplant this guy. His performance is too poor. He looks terrible. So the transplanter said, well, let's have him get back on his feet a little bit more. And plus at that time, they were delaying things because of the pandemic. They were still pushing people out. So he got transplanted eventually in November of 2021. I saw him in June 2021. So maintenance therapy, he was placed in ixazomib. You know, he developed angioedema. I couldn't believe it. I've never seen angioedema, you know. He said, I went to the emergency room, look at my picture. He showed me on the phone. Patients show their pictures on the phone all the time now. I said, okay, I guess we can't give you that drug. So I tried POM. Again, you know, like within like maybe the second month, he developed angioedema again, showed me the picture. I tried to give him Sirtec. I tried to give him, send him to an allergist. Mm-hmm. But we basically gave up on it. And I asked the transplanter, I said, what do you think I should give him? So he's on Dara. He's doing well on Dara. So this generates some questions. Of course, you presented the data about maintenance therapy. So what would be the ideal maintenance therapy now? They always push for Len, you know, daily, right, continuously. I don't think people tolerate that. They always need a break. So 3 weeks on, 1 week off is a lot of all of my patients, literally, that the post-transplant, that's what I do. So how long do you do the maintenance therapy? Are there any patients that you would reassess after 2 years and say, this is quits, you know, you would be okay? And if they relapse, what would you do after? So there's a slew of questions, you know, that is generated from this case.
So, Tom, any thoughts? I'll point out this is the second patient this morning who was referred to hospice who now is doing well. I would love a story. Usually that's like a checkpoint inhibitor story, but now these two are not. So Tom, the real world issues with maintenance therapy, and your thoughts about exazimib as maintenance.
So I'm not a big fan of exazimib as maintenance-based therapy. The randomized trial just showed a few months actually advantage, and so I don't use exazimib. It is convenient for patients, but it doesn't really prolong their PFS, so I'm not sure that's actually a good therapeutic to use, because we have other options, et cetera. And I do think a daratumumab-based maintenance strategy is a really good one. And, you know, in general, our maintenance has been with lenalidomide plus or minus daratumumab, and I think that it should be what we should all think about, except in the high-risk patients. The patients have a high-risk cytogenetic abnormality, and especially if they have more than one high-risk cytogenetic abnormality, then it's two or three-drug maintenance therapy for prolonged course, for upwards of 2 to 3 years. Again, we keep the pedal to the metal if they have high-risk disease. But a big good point is the MRD. Is here's where I think everybody should get used to doing MRD. And it's not hard. You can send a sample from the bone marrow up to Adaptive in Seattle, and they'll send you a report. Because we are doing studies now where we are doing dose de-escalation based on MRD. And that's going to become a real thing. So far, we're not ready to do escalation in my mind, but we are getting to the point where we are doing dose de-escalation, especially if they're MRD, sustained MRD negativity for 24 months or more. So I think that's going to be an important component of therapy.
Natalie, any other thoughts about real world?
You know, to Regina's point here, that in that Cassiopeia trial I showed, the daratumumab was given for 2 years and then stopped. And so, you know, they're showing that PFS benefit with limited therapy. And so I second what Tom says. The other thing, I mean, daratumumab, prolonged daratumumab in some patients is a little bit hard. And so I would favor trying to limit it.
So you stop at 2 years, but you stay with the lenalidomide?
Well, I think that's another, you know, to Tom's comments about trying to use MRD, you know, in an individual like this, that might be a consideration to stop both if you were MRD negative.
All right, Tom, let's take a look at immunotherapy, bispecifics, CAR T, and antibody drug conjugates again.
All right, so I'm going to take you through a whirlwind of immunotherapy for multiple myeloma. Those are my disclosures. And I will just really pick a few things that were presented at ASH and IMS and ASCO of 2024. This was a real-world experience that was presented by Dr. Sidana looking at real-world cilta-cel, one of our BCMA-targeted CAR T-cell therapies, and looking at about 240 patients. And overall response rate is actually still really good in the real world, 95%. 76% of the patients achieved a CR, and the majority of those patients, upper right, achieved MRD negativity, quite good. In the bottom right, we can look at the PFS. The PFS at 1 year is about 73%, and we'll see over time how that compares to the original CARTITUDE 1, which the median PFS was 36 months. That said, this population in the real world is a tougher population than what was done in CARTITUDE 1, so we all expect that it'll be a little bit lower. But this is very encouraging that in real world we're seeing very good responses. The other thing that Dr. Sidana showed, that there still are Achilles heels for us in terms of patients who don't have the durable responses, even with CAR T-cell therapy, like those with high risk, those with EMD, and specifically those who've had prior BCMA therapies. So basically, the patients on the bottom right who had prior BCMA have a lower PFS than the patients who had no exposure to BCMA. In fact, in the far right, if you had BCMA-targeted therapy within 6 months of your cilta-cel product, your PFS is actually less than 3 months. So it really drops the PFS. That speaks, you know, a lot to sequencing of these therapeutics. If you have a young person and you want to do BCMA, they probably should come for consult for a CAR T-cell therapy, because that's where they're going to get their longest progression-free survival. Now, Doris Hansen also did a real-world comparison of ide-cel versus cilta-cel, okay? And this is the only comparison that we're going to get in these two. And this is in the relapse refractory setting, and this is looking at PFS. And cilta-cel's in blue, ide-cel's in red. And you can see pretty much across the board, good PFS, prior BCMA, age less than 70, older than 70, independent of what they got for lymphodepletion chemotherapy, cilta-cel wins out in all those for PFS. But despite the higher efficacy, they did have actually higher toxicities, like more severe CRS, more delayed neurotoxicity, and more infection. And so we think of cilta-cel as being the more aggressive CAR and ide-cel maybe being the softer CAR. And for some, I think both are still needed right now. For some investigators and some myeloma docs, they would choose ide-cel for somebody that has more frail or older patient population, and they do cilta-cel in the younger population.
Before you get farther, just Natalie, maybe a little bit more about the neurotoxicity with cilta-cel. We've heard about Parkinsonian-like side effects. Mm-hmm. When do you see it? What do you do about it? Is it reversible?
Yeah, it's a really, I'm going to use the word feared complication, because at least right now it tends to be delayed. It tends to be showing up maybe 2 to 3 months post-CAR-T. And then I think the worrisome thing is that it doesn't respond very well to typical Parkinson's-like treatments. And so I think anybody who does enough of these has probably had a patient or two with it. It is relatively rare. I think one thing that we feel is important is trying to debulk patients more before their CAR-T, that seems to have an association with less neurotoxicity. But I think it's something that you have to inform patients about, particularly those that have a pretty large disease burden, that this could happen and this could be really sort of life-altering.
And maybe less CRS with debulking too. So Natalie, do you use a bridge? What type of bridging do you?
Well, I think, I don't know if you're presenting this, but a lot of people have turned to a very, very tiny course of talquetamab, and which seems to not have that signal that Tom is talking about with anti-BCMA therapy.
Yeah, it's not BCMA.
It's not BCMA, it's GPRC5D.
Makes a lot of sense.
And so if you use just a little dollop, if you will, like literally step-up dosing only, which a lot of people are doing, then you minimize some of the toxicities you can see with talquetamab and then get them successfully to CAR-T.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are looking at your data in terms of CAR-T and lymphoma. People yesterday were talking about it because they're starting to see maybe the same thing in lymphoma with CAR-T.
Okay, so when we see in the late line setting something that has a really good response, the general paradigm in myeloma is to try to bring it up earlier. So let's talk about a little earlier use of CAR T-cell therapy. So there's been two really large randomized phase 3 trials, the KARMA 3 trial, looking at ide-cel versus standard of care regimens, a combination of 5 different regimens for early relapse, 2 to 4 prior lines of therapy. And CARTITUDE 4 below this, again, randomized patients to receive cilta-cel versus 2 triplet-based therapies for salvage therapy in 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. And you look over to the right, you see that in both scenarios, the CAR T-cell shows higher overall response rates and also higher complete responses. So with ide-cel, 39%, with cilta-cel, it was over 70% complete responses. Now, if we look at PFS in the far right, the PFS in the ide-cel, the KARMA 3 trial for ide-cel was 13 months versus 3 months for the standard of care. With basically with cilta-cel, the PFS has not been reached, which was just under a year for the standard of care regimens. I think these data, we need to follow them over time, but I think these data point to the fact that we can start using CAR T-cells in earlier lines of therapy. And if we look at a recent 30-month follow-up, we look at overall survival, CARTITUDE 4, using it in earlier lines versus CARTITUDE 1, you know, median of 6 prior lines of therapy, you see a much different 30-month overall survival, and on the right, a much different PFS. And we think that we'll in fact have a much better PFS, longer than 35 months in patients that get cilta-cel earlier in lines of therapy. Now, what we don't see still is a flattening of the curve. So we have flattening of the curve envy from our lymphoma colleagues. We'll see. In terms of neurotoxicity, when we take it into the earlier line setting, we're still seeing it. About 9% cranial neuropathies, they respond to steroids. Again, typically happens between 3 weeks to 3 months after the CAR T-cell therapy. Some peripheral neuropathy, and in a few cases of Guillain-Barré, it's about 3%. And then we have the Parkinsonian, which is, you know, less than 1% to 2%, which is the most feared, as Natalie has pointed out. Now, what we'll say with CAR T-cell therapy, it's now going to be all over the map, right, for treating patients with multiple myeloma. And we're looking forward to seeing frontline therapy in the KARMA 4, CARTITUDE 5, and CARTITUDE 6 studies. So let's switch to bispecifics. We have 2 approved bispecifics, teclistamab and elranatamab. I'll show you data in a second. And we have some that hopefully are going to be in development and perhaps may be approved later this year. Now, how many BCMA bispecifics do we need? And I will tell you that we still need more. You know, maybe we need to get to the optimal one. We'll see, okay, over time. So these are updated data from Al Garfunk, looking at from ASCO 2024, from the Majestic 1 study, looking at overall response rates. Again, single agent response rates, 63%, 46% getting CR or better. We see a very good overall duration of response, median being 24 months on the left in the black curve. The PFS being about 11 months on the black curve on the right. Again, better obviously with responders. So a very active drug. What we see about toxicity is the most important toxicities is cytopenias. You do need to use growth factor with these patients. A lot of it is neutropenia. And on the right, we see infections. If you continuously go after BCMA, you're getting rid of normal plasma cells too. All patients are becoming hypogammaglobulinemic, and we're seeing infections upwards of over 50% getting three or four infections. You have to follow them very closely for infection. Now, from the MagnetisMM-3 study, looking at elranatamab, also a long-term follow-up, or an update, we see a PFS of about 17 months. OS was, median was 25 months. Really quite positive data for a single agent in the relapse refractory setting. And if we look at those people that responders, the duration of the response is actually quite favorable. And a lot of these patients actually were able to convert. Typically, it's weekly for 6 months, and you go to every other week. And some of these patients went to every four-month dosing. Here's some data also on the side effects from elranatamab. Same thing, hematologic toxicities and infections. But the infections, especially grade 3 and 4, seem to go down when you spread out the dose. One of the mitigation strategies is to spread out the dose. Here in the lighter blues, we see that there's decreased grade 3 or 4 infection when they go to every four-week dosing. Ongoing. Now we have other targets. One of the important ones is GPRC5D. That's talquetamab. Unfortunately, GPRC5D is also in the skin, in the nail beds, in the mouth. And so those are the unique toxicities that we get from GPRC-targeted therapy. But they do have really good overall response rates, 70 to 75%, PFS of about 14 months. In the first couple months, patients tend to get the skin and nail changes, skin dryness, brittle nails, they lose their nails, they get dysgeusia, there's weight loss, there's about 10% weight loss, but those get worse in the first 2 to 3 months, and then they get better over time. And some of the getting better is actually us dose reducing the medication. The most important thing in terms of infection, in my mind, is to really look at using IVIG as a primary prophylaxis. We start people off on IVIG right away in cycle one, and they get it monthly to keep their IgG greater than 400. Now, bispecifics are going to be used as dual-targeted agents over time. So these are some of the some of the emerging data. The TRIM2 study was talquetamab with daratumumab and pomalidomide. And you can see across the board in some naive CD38 or POM-naive or refractory, very high response rates, over 80%, and very high durability of response. Here's a combination study of talquetamab, the GPRC5D, with teclistamab, the BCMA, showing very high overall response rates, especially in the patients who have EMD. And on the right, I'll focus EMD. This is duration of response in patients who have EMD at the recommended phase 2 dosing of these drugs. This is the best data that we have for EMD. I think this is something that we're going to investigate further, and we'll see it might be the treatment of choice. Just like in CAR T-cell therapies, bispecifics now are all over the map, and really we have to find out what's the best space for bispecifics, what's the best space for CAR T-cell therapy. In the last 27 seconds,
we're going to give you more time, but hold on, just want to go back to a couple other things. So,
okay.
Natalie, Any granularity to the dysgeusia that you see, and what do you do about it?
Yeah, I think probably the key in the long run. Well, Cesar Rodriguez from Mount Sinai has been a big advocate of steroid rinses to start as soon as you start on talquetamab, and using that with nystatin to prevent thrush. I think it may modulate that some. There's a study that's actually going to compare that, but. I think the big thing is using less. And so I think the response rates are quite high, and we try to back down as soon as possible, and I think that helps. But unfortunately, even with some step-up dosing, people will get some significant toxicity right off the bat.
Are they unhappy?
Well, I will tell you, I will say they're very happy with the response, particularly if they're running out of options, but it's really unpleasant to lose your fingernails. I mean, and a lot of people do. They grow back, but... I think it's a risk-benefit as always. But I do try to make sure patients are well aware that this is a likelihood. And the last thing I just want to make is, it's been my observation, I think there's a paper coming out, that people who don't get this toxicity don't seem to respond very well.
Well,
and the people who get it, they respond great. I don't know if you've seen the same thing, Tom.
One other point, Tom, and also I'm curious about Regina's thoughts on this, is bispecifics in the community. We were talking about this yesterday in lymphoma. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times you see this scenario of starting in the tertiary center, transferring to the community-based setting. What about starting in the community setting? Are we going to get to that point?
So I do think that these drugs are so important drugs, and they're going to be used in all different cancers, that the community is going to take this on for sure, and it's going to go, you know, through the community full speed. With the IMWG, I'll just put a plug that we are going to have a map on how to do it in the community on the website for the IMG, through the IMF. The IMF and the IMWG Immunotherapy Committee, we're putting together, here's what we recommend to start this in the community and to start it off, you know, treatment inpatient, outpatient, hybrid, et cetera.
Regina, any questions about that? You know, Florida Cancer Specialists is always ahead in terms of integrating new agents, research into practice. What about bispecifics and myeloma?
I personally haven't used it yet, but our centers are in training. Of course, you know, scared of ICANS, you know, CRS. But just like anything, we're scared of something when you read about side effects. Eventually, we'll get used to it. It's like, you know, when venetoclax was introduced, you know, tumor lysis. Now it's nothing. You know, we just kind of adapt to it.
It's funny, when you said that, I flashed on an FCS retreat we did, and when HMA venetoclax was coming out in AML, and everybody in the audience says, "What are we going to be doing that?" I'm going, "Yeah, you're going to be doing that for sure." And of course, they were. All right, belantamab. I'll tell you, Tom. I always love, you know, I always relate this experience. We did a series where I did interviews with patients with myeloma, and I interviewed this patient who had been on belantamab and doing great. Was that was your
patient, right?
That was
still on belantamab. Now is 7 years.
Yeah, so I guess it was 3 years ago, because at that point, the patient had been on it for 4 years, and that was when it got pulled off the, you know, from the FDA. Right. And here I'm looking at this patient, and now she's still on it.
Still
amazing.
Still in remission. Yeah.
All right.
So I will tell you, belantamab, it's my 2024 comeback kit of the year, okay? And this is why. So it was initially approved based on a phase 2 study that had a single agent response rate of about 30%. And then it went on to a randomized phase 3 trial, which we were hoping would get it approved. But it was belantamab versus Pom Dex. It did not meet its statistical endpoints, and the FDA withdrew it from the market, right? You could still get it compassionate use if you wanted, but... But that said, there were ongoing phase 3 trials, two phase 3s that we just heard of last year, the DREAM-7 study as well as the DREAM-8 study. These are very large studies. These are randomized studies. DREAM-7, it was belantamab bortezomib dex versus daratumumab bortezomib dex. So it was really belantamab versus daratumumab in combination with bortezomib and dexamethasone in 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. The DREAM-8 was belantamab pomalidomide index versus bortezomib pomalidomide index. So it was belantamab versus bortezomib with pom-dex as the doublet. And so, you know, I'll cut right to the data, and that is for DREAM-7, the belantamab bortezomib dexamethasone had an overall response rate of 83%, with close to 35% of patients getting a complete response, very nice complete response. And in DREAM-8, you see patients that actually had an overall response rate of about 77%, with about 40% of patients getting CR. And in both the belantamab arms, way better than the other arm. But the more impressive thing actually was the PFS. If we look at the DREAM-7 PFS, the DREAM-7 PFS was 37 months. That's like what Natalie presented earlier with IKEMA, one of the longest PFS we've seen in the 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy, versus only 13 months with daratumumab, bortezomib index. So belantamab versus daratumumab, hands down, beat daratumumab, which is really amazing. And in the bottom, we need a longer follow-up, but that said, at 12 months, 71% PFS versus 51% with belantamab pomdex versus bortezomib pomdex with a good hazard ratio of 0.52. So this drug is coming back, and what Natalie said earlier is the key thing. And also in practice, a lot of people say, well, I'm not going to use this because of all the eye toxicity. But in fact, eye toxicity, there's mitigation strategies for eye toxicity. This data shows from Dream 7 that in the first 3 months, when you're using it either every 3 or every 4 weeks, you get about 20% of patients have significant ocular toxicity. And that's mitigated by dose holds and then reduction in doses, and then to lengthen out the interval. And if as you go over time here, this goes from 3 months to a year to 2 years, et cetera, over time we're going to every 3 to 4 week dosing, to every 6 week dosing, to every 12 week dosing. And these patients can get, you know, basically every 12 week dosing and still maintain the response. That's why patients love this. I'll stop there. Yeah.
So Natalie, just kind of curious, your patient has been on for 7 years and she had ophthalmic issues.
She's had she was locked into, because of her study, this Q3-week dosing. And so she did have some holds, but mostly it was dry eyes, and that recovered very quickly. But, you know, as Tom said, if you have really longer intervals, you know, months, you see so much less of it.
Tom, where do you see belantamab coming in, and do you see responses after CAR-T and bispecifics?
Well, that's a really good question, and we're trying to go at our database, our real-world database, to see about that. Most of the data that we have right now, because belantamab was taken out of the market, was belantamab before CARs and bispecifics, so we need to see about after it. But I think there's a special patient population that this is for. Those patients who have really high risk for infection, those patients that want to come to the center, to your center and our centers, a lot less frequently, Q3 months. I think this is going to have a significant niche that's going to involve patients that you don't think can tolerate a CAR or bispecific, and you think it'll be a much easier way for them to get a BCMA-targeted therapeutic.
So final question from the audience, going back to Selinex or Natalie, starting dose.
I don't start above 60, and I am very happy to drop to 40 quickly.
All right, we're going to move on. Thank you so much.
Thank you.